Okay, I see we can cross Kristen off. I don't think Barbara Munson's here. But Song Kim, if you're here, did not return exam one to the file. I don't have it, so make sure to check. Maybe I put it, well, I didn't see it, so I'll look again. Check your stuff, just to be sure. Barbara Munson's not here, so. Before we start, continue, I should say, with gas transport, which is continuation of talking about hemoglobin. There's been a number of questions about myoglobin and hemoglobin, not a number, but a few questions about myoglobin and hemoglobin. So I came up with these kind of cartoon drawings. The first one is of myoglobin, and it's basically a protein starting with an amino and going to a carboxyl end with a heme group, which remember the heme group is an organic cofactor. It's a prosthetic group, and it's wedged in a groove in the protein. Hemoglobin is similar to myoglobin, but more complex. So it's basically four different proteins, each starting with an amino terminus going to the carboxyl terminus, and each one of those proteins has a heme prosthetic group stuck in a groove in it. So that's kind of three-dimensionally what these things look like. Remember, physiologically, myoglobin's purpose is to store oxygen and only release it during times of crisis or extreme oxygen deprivation. Hemoglobin, on the other hand, is continually releasing oxygen or oxygenating your tissues by picking up oxygen in the lungs and delivering it to the tissues. Notice again, hemoglobin has four places where it can pick up oxygen. Four heme groups can pick up four oxygen molecules. This then is the big picture of the heme group, if you will. So I kind of blew the heme group up. And this explains the coordination sites of the heme group. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 coordination sites. 1, 2, 3, and 4 are occupied by the nitrogen that are in that kind of porphyrin ring. The fifth site is the proximal histidine, and the sixth site is where the oxygen or carbon monoxide binds. Remember, at any given time, there's some heme and some myoglobin with carbon monoxide bound to it, but the body has a mechanism to discriminate, so mainly it binds oxygen, unless we're in a room filled with carbon monoxide, at which point it will favor that over the oxygen. Notice the distal histidine is not bound in one of the coordination sites, but instead is electrostatically attracted to the oxygen or carbon monoxide when it is bound at the sixth site. So that's what those dotted lines mean. You also have a picture in your notes with the dashed line, meaning it's just electrostatic attraction. It's not actually part of the coordination to the iron ferrous Fe2+ molecule. So that's kind of cartoon-wise what these things look like. And again, hemoglobin is kind of like a more complex myoglobin. And again, its purpose biochemically is to oxygenate our tissues. And that's what it does primarily. Now, oxygenation, and we talked a little bit about oxygen affinity curves. And again, the difference between the two curves is myoglobin has that very simple curve. And as you look at it, you can see that most of the time, myoglobin has oxygen bound to it. It only lets it go at very low pressure. So again, during times of crisis or oxygen deprivation from strenuous exercise, anything like that. Hemoglobin, on the other hand, had that sigmoidal-shaped curve. And again, if you go to the notes where you have the two curves on top of each other, it's easier to see. And the basic concept, again, to get from the curve is that hemoglobin is letting go of its oxygen most of the time. So most of our normal physiological PO2s, oxygen pressures, hemoglobin is delivering oxygen to our tissues, which again is its purpose. That's what it does. Picks it up in the lungs, delivers it to the tissues. Now we had said because of hemoglobin's structure relative to myoglobin's a little more complex, we're going to see that it is capable of something called cooperative binding. And when we talk about that, we need to introduce the term allosteric site. And an allosteric site is just a site other than an active site. So the active site is usually, for instance, an enzyme where it binds its substrate. So any other site that we don't call the active site, we call allosteric. And basically, something binding to an allosteric site can be either a good thing, activating, or a bad thing, inhibiting. So it can be either way. It is not necessarily good or bad. To talk about hemoglobin, we also will introduce the terms tense and relaxed. And these terms do not only refer to hemoglobin, but to many different proteins. And it turns out that in the quaternary structure of hemoglobin, if one oxygen binds to one of the heme prosthetic groups, remember at the sixth coordination site, then the whole molecule, this whole heme, kind of relaxes. So that's the R state. When hemoglobin is sitting around and has no oxygen bound, it is tense. So those are the R and the T, relaxed and tensed forms of an allosteric protein. And the relaxed form always has a higher affinity for oxygen. So anytime the hemoglobin molecule becomes relaxed, it increases its affinity for oxygen. And that's kind of a complex looking picture of the cleft, which we're going to talk more about now, that happens when the oxygen binds. So oxygen binding relaxes hemoglobin. The little squares, again, are just basically the cartoon. Translate the one I drew on the board to that. So you've got four different proteins, two alphas, two betas, all bound together, connected to make quaternary structure, one active hemoglobin molecule. Well, when an oxygen binds, when we have oxyhemoglobin, a cleft actually opens up between these two pairs. And that's what you saw on that first picture, that little 15 degree is the cleft that's opening up. So this little thing here is the cleft. So here's tense. So you've got your four proteins, looks kind of like that. An oxygen binds and it relaxes. And during that relaxation, a little kind of hole or cleft opens up in the molecule as it relaxes. What's actually happening with the chemistry there has to do with salt bridges. So the way the quaternary structure of the hemoglobin is maintained, so the way we can take the alpha, alpha, beta, beta, two alphas, two betas, and the way we put them all together, and here's another representation of the same thing that I drew on the board and the same as your picture. You see you've got four proteins. Each one has an amino and a carboxyl terminus. So there's four different proteins. And the way they all kind of interact or stay together is via salt bridges. And salt bridges are going to form between basic and acidic R groups, basic and acidic amino acids. So you see salt bridges between things like aspartic acid and arginine, aspartic acid and lysine, the carboxy terminus of the protein and lysine. So we see salt bridges between acidic and basic residues. So when there is no oxygen, when we have deoxyhemoglobin, when it's tense, that's what it looks like. All of these salt bridges are here. When an oxygen binds, it moves from the tense to the relaxed state, and basically what happens is the salt bridges break. So we're actually moving the structure as the oxygen binds to that sixth coordination site in one of the heme groups. Everything kind of shifts slightly, and you can see if it shifts, all of these little strings, these chains, are going to get pulled a little bit, and the salt bridges break, and that cleft opens up. So an oxygen binding induces a conversion from tense to relaxed. Tense to relaxed. And that's what cooperativity is, which we introduced last time. It basically means that when an oxygen binds and the molecule hemoglobin goes from tense to relaxed, it increases its affinity for more oxygen. So when the salt bridges are disrupted, the cleft opens up and the molecule relaxes. It increases affinity for more oxygen. So basically, logically, the big picture is it makes sense because hemoglobin goes to the lungs, binds an oxygen. It would not be efficient for it to then take one oxygen and go back and oxygenate tissues, but it's much more efficient, obviously, if it takes four. So if it fills its binding sites. And this pretty much assures that it does fill its binding sites because when it binds one, it increases its affinity for more, basically fills the other three sites. Goes off, oxygenates the tissues, come back to the lungs. There's this going back and forth from your lungs to your tissues. So that's what cooperativity means. One binds and increases affinity for binding of more. Doesn't always just apply to hemoglobin and oxygen, but this is the case we're looking at. When one oxygen binds, it increases affinity for more oxygen. But that's the concept of cooperativity. That's what it's called. Again, you can see in this picture what's happening as we go from tense to relaxed. And we can see it more graphically if we look at that proximal histidine, which, remember, is coordinated to the fifth coordination site in the heme group. So the picture shows there's the proximal histidine coordinated to the iron. And there's the heme plane, that's the ring. So that's our heme structure. And the oxygen binds, and you notice it pulls, again, the whole chain along with it, kind of pulls that iron down into the plane a little bit and breaks those salt bridges that were holding it up, holding it together in a tense state. Basically, it frees up the subunit and increases affinity. Again, more oxygen combined. More oxygen combined. And again, it makes sense when you continue to think about the big picture, which is the overall biochemistry or physiology of what hemoglobin's trying to do. It's trying to move into your lungs and pick up oxygen and deliver it to your tissues. Because most of your processes, biochemical processes, reactions, metabolism, all require oxygen. So we've got to get it down there somehow. And this is how we do it. This is how we deliver it. So again, cooperativity doesn't only apply here. We'll see it also in other instances. So very important for hemoglobin. Now the next three things we're going to talk about, there's a lot of material, but the main kind of point that we're going to see is that protons, H+, also known as the Bohr effect, carbon dioxide, not monoxide, but dioxide, and something called 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate, which is actually a byproduct of glycolysis or metabolism of glucose, which we will see towards the end of the semester. And 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate is abbreviated BPG, and it's found in the tissues. All three of these, protons, CO2, and BPG, can induce a conversion from the relaxed to the tense state. So the main thing to keep in mind as we go through this material that we're going to cover now, and it's going to seem like a lot of facts and stuff, but the overall is that these three things, protons, CO2, and BPG, induce a conversion of hemoglobin from being relaxed back to being tense. And when we go from relaxed to tense, we decrease our affinity for oxygen. Again, it's the exact opposite of going from tense to relaxed. So if we go from tense to relaxed, we increase affinity. So therefore, logically, we can say if we go from relaxed to tense, we decrease affinity. So we're going to go through now in detail what these things are, the Bohr effect, or protons, what CO2 does in the system, and what BPG does. But the results of all the three are the same, so you want to keep that in mind. So oxygen binding and pretty much everything in biochemistry is very sensitive to physiological changes in pH. So very sensitive to protons. That's why we spent a lot of time talking about acidosis, alkalosis. We looked at cases of metabolic acidosis. And we know the body likes to keep pH range very narrow, 7.35 to 7.45, very narrow range. So that's telling us it's very sensitive to changes. Well, contracting muscle builds up what we call lactic acid. Most of us have actually felt this phenomena, so it's something we can relate to. If you exercise strenuously and beyond a certain point, you actually feel burning in your muscles. That is real. It is lactic acid. And as we produce lactic acid from strenuous exercise, we're increasing our H+ concentrations. So we're making the environment more acidic, meaning we're decreasing pH. And what this does is it promotes oxygen dissociation. It promotes the conversion of hemoglobin from relaxed to tense. And it fulfills a greater requirement for oxygen. Because obviously if we are exercising at this level, our tissues are going to require significantly more oxygen than they do as we're sitting here at our desk. So we have to have some way to deal with that. So basically the lactic acid that's building up antagonizes binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. And if you look at these curves, which again are oxygen affinity curves for hemoglobin, so we've got that sigmoidal shape. And as you look at those curves, you can see each one is a different pH. You've got 7.6, 7.4, 7.2. So we'll call the middle one normal, 7.4. And as the pH then gets lower, goes down to about 7.2, you notice that the curve is shifting to the right. So you can write that down. The curve is shifting to the right as the pH decreases. And that is meaning greater oxygen dissociation, more oxygenation of the tissues. More oxygenation of the tissues. So again, what we're doing is we're inducing a conversion from relaxed to tense. Now notice the little note here in the lungs. We're going to find with all three of these cases, again, proton, CO2, and BPG, that in the lungs, the opposite is occurring. And again, it makes sense, because in the lungs, we want hemoglobin to actually get more affinity, increase its affinity for oxygen, so it can work even more efficiently. So as in our tissues, our pH decreases, it actually slightly increases in the lungs. And remember, we're looking at, this is slight, 7.6, 7.4, 7.2. These aren't pHs like we see in the lab, where we go from 2 to 11. Too extreme. When we're talking about biochemistry, it's like 7.6, 7.4, 7.2. Very slight changes in pH. So in the lungs, we're actually increasing affinity. So that means our hemoglobin is basically becoming more efficient. It's going to the lungs and it's very quickly filling all four of those sites, all four of the six coordination position on each of its heme groups with oxygen. It's running to the tissues and it is increasing delivery to the tissues, increasing dissociation in the tissues. So in other words, overall, it's oxygenating our tissues much more efficiently and more rapidly, which it would clearly need to do if we are exercising to the point where we're building lactic acid, which again is something most of us have felt at one time or another. So what's happening chemically as it converts from relaxed to tense is the histidine residues are actually becoming protonated, and we're actually inducing or increasing salt bridge formation. So remember, because we're now at a lower pH, about 7.2, we have lots of H plus ions around, so things are getting protonated. So what's actually happening chemically is the amino acid residue in the hemoglobin protein chain becomes protonated, and we get more salt bridges, which remember, salt bridges are a characteristic of the tense state. When the salt bridges are there, things are tense. When they break, things are relaxed. So that's actually the chemistry that's going on that's causing the conversion from relaxed to tense, causing it to drop its oxygen, dissociate, leave its oxygen behind. So that's the Bohr effect, they call it. Again, it's a pH effect. Primarily, we're talking about strenuous exercise. Carbon dioxide. We're going to see a lot of carbon dioxide as we start to talk about the metabolic pathway. It's a major byproduct of metabolism. And that was one of the questions on the last exam. As we looked at the buffering equation, I asked you to explain it very briefly. And one of the things you needed to know was that CO2 is a byproduct of metabolism, which we had said. And of course, it's also part of respiration, because the CO2 travels to the lungs and we respirate it out, take oxygen in. So there's always this exchange. So if we start to accumulate CO2, so the concentrations go up a bit, that's basically a symbol or characteristic or a sign of active metabolism. So for some reason our metabolism has become heightened, a bit more active. Again, we may be exercising. We may have induced it by using caffeine, anything like that, that is going to make our metabolism more active. Well, anytime we activate our metabolism, we're going to have an increased O2 requirement. Because remember, all of these biochemical reactions and all these metabolic pathways require oxygen. So once again, CO2 is going to do the exact same thing, have the exact same effects as decreasing pH. And that is CO2 lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen so that it can release it more efficiently to the tissues. release it more efficiently to the tissues. Now remember, if we're producing more CO2, because our metabolism's heightened for whatever reason, then our lungs are going to be respirating more efficiently or expelling more CO2. So the lungs are working a little harder, and the CO2 in the lungs is kept lower. And because of that, again, we have the exact same sort of effect, and that is that in the lungs, the hemoglobin's affinity for oxygen increases slightly. So it takes it up more efficiently, a little bit faster, so that it can deliver it more efficiently to the tissues. So again, looking at the curves, we go from 20 to 40 to 80 millimeters of mercury. So we're measuring pressures of CO2, 20 to 40 to 80. And once again, what's happening is in this sigmoidal curve is it's shifting to the right, which means more oxygen dissociation, more delivery of oxygen, and it's all in response to an increased need in the tissues for oxygen. So again, strenuous exercise, if we produce lactic acid in the muscles, we're producing H+ ions, we're lowering pH, we increase the need for oxygen. If we induce or increase our metabolic rates for whatever reason, we're increasing the need in our tissues for oxygen. Hemoglobin can respond. Now, what's going on chemically? There is a specific chemical effect of CO2. And again, that's in terms of the conversion of the relaxed to the tense state. And it turns out that the carbon dioxide can bind to the N-terminus of these protein chains in hemoglobin and create a salt bridge. So again, as we go from relaxed to tense, what we're talking about is we're favoring or building salt bridges. We're producing salt bridges. So again, it's through these salt bridges. And again, the salt bridges being there are significant for the tense state. So whenever we say tense, we think salt bridges. When we say relaxed, we think we've broken them, we've opened a cleft, we've relaxed it. So again, the same basic effect going on in the lungs and the tissues in response to CO2. Bisphosphoglycerate, again, it's produced primarily in red blood cells from the metabolism of glucose. We will see that red blood cells are very simple creatures, and basically that's pretty much all they do is metabolize glucose. That's how they live. They have a very simple system. And in the metabolism of glucose, they produce 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate. Well, 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate, or BPG, being produced as the red blood cells are eagerly metabolizing glucose, also has the effect of lowering hemoglobin's affinity for oxygen. So increases in concentration of bisphosphoglycerate also signal an increased need for oxygen in the tissues. Oxygen in the tissues. Again, in the lungs, the same effect as with CO2 and with protons, and that is that we actually increase affinity in the lungs for oxygen. Look at the curve. You'll see the exact same thing as we convert from relaxed to tense. The curve has shifted to the right, meaning more oxygen dissociation, more oxygenation of the tissues. Basically, the bisphosphoglycerate works in a little bit different fashion in terms of its chemistry, and that is that it actually wedges itself into a cleft in the hemoglobin molecule, and so it can actually itself, with its structure, 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate, wedges itself in there and affects hemoglobin's ability to keep oxygen bound. So basically it stops it from binding oxygen. Of course, not in the lungs. In the lungs, the cleft gets too small. The bisphosphoglycerate is not bound there. So in the lungs, the hemoglobin can pick up the oxygen. It gets down to the tissues, and the bisphosphoglycerate kind of forces it out so that it oxygenates the tissues. And if you look at the structure of bisphosphoglycerate, which you don't need to know, it is a highly negatively charged molecule. So that's why the little negative sign. And it interacts as it wedges itself in with all of the positively charged or basic amino acid residues in the protein structure. So it starts to interact with lysine, histidine, arginine. And again, the effect, stabilizing the T state, the tenth state. So again, all three do exactly the same thing. All three increase affinity in the lungs. Affinity, meaning efficiency, speed, all of those things one would think. In the tissues, all three induce a transition from relaxed to tense, causing hemoglobin to efficiently oxygenate or drop, leave behind, dissociate its oxygen into the tissues. Also, in all three, as you look at that sigmoidal curve, the oxygen affinity curve, it shifts to the right in all three cases, which is the same thing as saying increases dissociation. Now, one little different one, and that's the clinical correlate. This is the only one in which the case will be opposite, if you will. And the clinical correlate is fetal hemoglobin. Normal adult hemoglobin, we've said, is basically alpha 2, beta 2. So four proteins, two of them alpha, two of them beta. Notice fetal hemoglobin is alpha 2, gamma 2. Alpha 2, gamma 2. So it has a different structure. And it turns out that as we go from beta to gamma, there's actually a difference in the amino acid sequence, and we have a lot more serine than we do histidine. Remember, histidine is the basic R group, basic amino acid, has a great ability to accept and donate protons. Serine does not. It's got a hydroxyl group on it, it's fairly hydrophilic, but it doesn't have this basic nature that histidine does. So by taking out the histidine in fetal hemoglobin, we basically are disrupting salt bridge formation. And remember, when we say salt bridge formation, we immediately think of the tense state. So fetal hemoglobin is very relaxed, is a way to think of it. It has a very high affinity for oxygen, a higher affinity for oxygen than normal adult hemoglobin. This makes sense because when you think of a fetus, it obviously needs to be oxygenated and it obviously can't breathe. So the way it is oxygenated is from the mother. So maternal hemoglobin, oxygen from maternal hemoglobin flows easily and directly to fetal hemoglobin. So you'll notice here as we look at the sigmoidal curve again, this time it's shifting left. So fetal hemoglobin, the curve is to the left, meaning it has a much higher affinity for oxygen than maternal hemoglobin. But again, the main point being, this is good because we want to optimize the transfer of oxygen from maternal to fetal. Thus, we oxygenate the fetus. And then, of course, interestingly, when the fetus is born, there has to be a quick changeover from fetal to normal adult hemoglobin so that it can begin then to oxygenate itself because it begins to breathe. So one of the many things that goes on at birth, or needs to go on at birth, is that change from the gamma to the beta. So again, just an interesting clinical correlate of how we oxygenate a fetus. So that kind of summarizes the story of myoglobin and hemoglobin, which are both proteins, both globular proteins. So an example of proteins, which we begin to introduce, we're going to go on and talk a lot about enzymes, which are another type of protein. Again, the heme group is key. Remember, it's an organic cofactor, a prosthetic group, and it's key because that's where the oxygen binds. Binds to the sixth coordination site of the heme group. Gas exchange, which we pretty much, or gas transport, talked about, has to do with the roles of myoglobin and hemoglobin, particularly hemoglobin, which again, keep in mind, its role is to oxygenate tissues. And we looked at three examples where there's an increased need for oxygen in the tissues. So the Bohr effect, or protons, pH, CO2, and BPG, and what that does to gas transfer. So now we're going to look at kind of another protein. And this is a very, very brief introduction to a course you probably have taken or will take or definitely will take if you go into any kind of healthcare field, and that's immunology. So this is like a very cursory introduction to immunology. And when we talk about immunology, we're talking about antibodies and antigens. And in particular, we'll look at the antibody. It's a circulating glycoprotein. And when we talk about antibodies, we're talking about lymphocytes, white blood cells. So we've gone from hemoglobin, gone from red blood cells to white blood cells. The immune response. The critical antibodies are a critical or crucial part of the defense system, the immunology, the immune system. All of the antibodies, and we'll see there are billions, belong to a family of proteins that's called immunoglobulins, probably a word you've heard. And they're named immunoglobulins because they're globular proteins and their role in the immune system, immune response. And what they do overall, their main biochemical physiological purpose is they recognize antigens and bind and destroy antigens. And antigens are foreign invaders, things that we do not want in our bodies. Let me see, there was one mistake that I hope I remember correct. Let me see, what do your notes say? Did they say four or three? Three, good. Okay, I remember to correct that. So my notes still say four subunits. But immunoglobulins are basically three pieces, which you can clearly see. There's a one, a two, and a three. They look kind of like a Y. You've often seen them drawn as a Y. Sometimes a sideways Y has a Y shape. And basically they all are kind of similar in this structure, so that's why we're going to look at it, although some are more complex. So we can have multiple subunits, multiple Y. And the features of the subunits that you want to notice are the heavy and the light chains. And the heavy chains are drawn with the really dark line, solid dark line. So there's two identical heavy chains and two identical light chains. The light ones being kind of just the little bit colored in, not the heavy dark. The chains are joined by intra-chain disulfide bonds. So you notice lots of disulfide bonds kind of holding the whole structure together. There's disulfide bonds within the heavy and light chains, and then there are disulfide bonds holding the heavy to the light chain. So lots of cysteines. This particular picture is of what's called an IgG. Not overly important that you know that, but it's a basic immunoglobulin. You kind of notice that they kind of come together at a hinge region. We call that the hinge region. That's why it's labeled hinge region. Notice again all the disulfide bonds. That's what's stabilizing this thing. You also notice that there are V's and C's on the diagram. The V stands for variable, and the C stands for constant, which we'll talk about. Notice that the variable regions, and there's one on the heavy chain and one on the light chain, are occurring at the tips of the Y. And those are globular domains. Remember, these are proteins, and if you look very closely at the drawings, you can see the amino end and the carboxyl end. So here's the amino end. These are all amino acids, proteins, carboxyl end. Here's the amino end, amino acids, and goes to the carboxyl end. So again, it's proteins. We're talking about types of proteins. So the tips of the Y are the variable regions. Well, the variable regions at those tips are what form the binding sites. So they're globular proteins, meaning they can bind something, and they bind antigens. And in each antibody that we look at, it has two identical binding sites. So as we look at this antibody, those two binding sites are identical. So the two binding sites are identical within a single antibody molecule, but no two antibodies are exactly alike. So we have huge diversity of antibodies. But if we pull out one, like we've done here, like if we go in, take a white blood cell, a lymphocyte, and pull out one antibody, this particular antibody has two identical binding sites. So the body is obviously capable of producing millions and billions of different variable regions. Variable regions. Yeah. The V. V heavy, V light. V heavy, V light. These are identical binding sites at the tips of the Y. This is the variable region. Yeah.
And how about clonal antibodies? So they have the same variable region?
Yeah, within. Yeah, because they're monoclonal. So you made one copy. You made copies of the same one.
So
yeah.
The thing is that no two antibodies are alike. For the regular circulating one?
Right. It's a variable region that recognizes the antigen. We're going to talk a lot more about the variable region. The constant region then, the C regions, which are again everything else except these tips, so the whole rest of this thing, are pretty much constant within classes. So that means that as the body makes these things and it has to make so many different ones, most of it is the same. And the only part of the protein that's really different is in the variable region. So as it codes, and again we read with the codons and we make these proteins, most of it you'll notice is the same, at least within classes. And you have all these different classes. This is an IgG. And as you study immunology, there's many classes of different antibodies. We can actually take this thing in the lab and digest it and break it apart. And the way we do that is that hinge region, we can actually mix it with some enzymes. Pepsin and papain tend to be the two that we use. And it cleaves this thing into two pieces. And the two pieces that it cleaves it into, we call the Fab and the FC. And you probably heard these words. And the Fab is the antigen binding piece, and that's the arms of the Y. These are the Fabs, labeled FAB. And this piece down here is the FC, and the C basically means crystallizable fragment. And basically it's that constant crystallizable fragment that mediates the functions that are common in the different classes, so as we try to class these things. And of course, the Fab part, the antigen binding part, is where the variable regions are, which is the most important part, really, of the molecule in terms of its function. And we're going to see how those variable regions recognize antigens. Notice that this piece, the crystallizable piece, is made entirely of heavy chains. So the light chains are only involved in the variable regions, only involved in the Fab fragments, the antigen binding pieces. Now as you look at the next picture, what we've done is we've basically taken the Y and depict it a little bit different. So again, there's our Y. Notice that those variable regions, so variable L, light chain, variable H, heavy chain, actually have regions in them that are hyper, even more variable. We call them hypervariable regions. Hypervariable regions. And so as you look at these chains, the light chain actually contains three hypervariable regions, and the heavy chain contains four hypervariable regions. So in those little tiny regions within the variable chain, heavy and light, there are little pieces that are particularly variable, so we call them hyper, meaning more, even more variable. And these hypervariable regions vary tremendously. There's another word for them. We call them complementarity determining regions, or CDRs. So there's three CDRs on the light chain and four CDRs on the heavy chain. And remember, keeping in mind the big picture, that each of the antibodies has two of these tips, because these are the tips of the Y. So there's three CDRs on the light chain here, three CDRs on the light chain here, four CDRs on the heavy chain here, four CDRs on the heavy chain there. And it's those combination of all seven of those CDRs, again, three from the light chain and four from the heavy chain, that make the binding pocket where the antigen binds. Where the antigen binds. And I don't know if I have a picture. Draw a little picture. So basically an expanded picture of what that looks like is, I like to think of them as like little teeth. So 3 CDRs on the light chain, 4 on the heavy chain, is basically those 7 CDRs is where the antigen binds. And there's actually a set of features on the antigen, chemical features, that are recognized by these CDRs. And that's basically what a haptin is. Again, it's terminology, nomenclature. The set of features that represent usually specific chemical groups on antigens, on bacteria, on foreign invaders, on anything that's not self, are what's recognized by the 7 CDRs. Remember, you've got another tip over here that's doing the same thing within one antibody, because we have 2 identical binding pockets, binding regions on this antibody. So basically, right inside this tip of the Y is where the binding occurs. So in here goes the antigen, in here goes the antigen. And the set of features on the surface of the antigen interact with the antibody through ionic bonds, salt bridges, hydrophobic interactions, hydrogen bonding. We're not talking about covalent type of things. So not covalent interactions, but interactions more of a hydrophobic, salt bridge, hydrogen bonding nature. That's how they interact. Now the haptin, or the set of features, is what's key to producing vaccines. And so basically you can take the surface features, the haptin, the components, the chemical components of a virus, a dead virus, one that's not virulent, and inject it into somebody, and that will of course cause the immune system to produce antibodies for those surface components. And then basically the way that works is then later, once that person is exposed to the actual live virus, it's ready to go. So the immune system responds quickly and says, this is something I've seen, I have antibodies for this, and quickly takes care of it. And of course that either means the person doesn't get sick or gets much more mild form of whatever the virus is. Most recent success, the chickenpox virus. More difficult things like HIV. HIV is kind of a very smart virus, and it has a, seems to be endless ability to alter those surface features. So that every time they think they pin it down, it changes itself. So we can't ever quite get a hold of the surface features in order to get a vaccine. They're very difficult. Lots of viruses are that way. Think of them as sort of almost smart. They know what we're after, and they can change that set of chemical features. So those are really difficult ones. Autoimmune diseases, another big area of research, big problem. Lupus, many forms of arthritis, lots of things are caused by autoimmune problems. And autoimmune problems most basically mean the body can no longer recognize self. So obviously for the immune system to work this way, your particular immune system has to be able to recognize your blood cells, your pancreas, your muscles, what belongs to you, hence what is foreign, what is a foreign invader. And sometimes for whatever reason, still undiscovered, it loses its ability to recognize self. And you can clearly see that if you begin to develop antibodies towards yourself, this will cause many problems. Not a good thing. Autoimmune diseases. All based on immunology, all based on the structure, the features, the way the antibody works and the way it binds antigens. The way it binds antigens. So again,